Hey, Adam.
Hey, Dee.
Do you know what customer centricity is?
I hope I do, but I'm sure you'll tell me otherwise.
Well, let's get into it.
Okay, this is CX Etera, where we explore the future of CX.
And a little bit more. So I'm really excited to talk about customer centricity, not just because of the field in which we work, but because somebody recently said to me that they think that the term is akin to executive presence, one of those like nothing burger concepts that people lord over each other when they can't quite give specific feedback. And I actually disagree on both counts. Like, I think that people have badly articulated those terms, but that they make up something quite critical that we just didn't or don't have the vocabulary for yet, or haven't like thought about in a streamlined, organized way. So this episode, I think we should get into what customer centricity is and isn't. And also just like in our personal experiences, when do we feel like we've been in organizations that have been customer centric? And when do we feel like maybe they've been going in the other direction?
I love that, but I feel like first, because you caught me off guard with that comment about executive presence. Like, can you say more about that? Like, the executive presence isn't real thing.
Okay, yeah, and we should cover this in an Etera episode too, because it's like a good one to talk about as a leader. But you haven't heard this from people, like people saying, oh, I hate when someone tells me that I like don't have executive presence. I don't think that's like an actual real thing. And everybody just uses it because they like don't know how to give me actual real feedback.
No, I haven't. I haven't heard this discourse.
Really? Oh my God. It's everywhere. Like, in fact, there's like a lot of writing on like how particularly telling women that they're not customer or sorry, that they're not, that they don't have executive presence is kind of like sexist. And then there's like a backlash to that feedback of like, no, it's an actual anyway. So like, it's been out there for a while. It's not like a new thing. But the idea is like, you know, when you're giving someone feedback in their annual review, mid-year cycle, or just like generic feedback about like developing their executive presence, that it tends to be like not an actual tangible skill, you know, or competency with skills that like people can develop, that it's really just like a lazy point of feedback from somebody who is frustrated about something that they can't quite figure out about like someone they're managing.
But you don't necessarily agree with that line of reasoning you're saying. You actually do think there's like something that they're pointing at. They're just saying executive presence instead of being more specific about the actual thing.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think like people that have experienced this, and I've experienced this like in my early career days where I would have people talk to me about executive presence, and like I would try to be like, all right, let's dig deeper. Can you give me, you know, examples and or like qualities of executive presence? And it was very difficult for them to do it, right? So I think people that talk about that, like, I'm not saying they're not right. They're right. If they're not getting concrete feedback that breaks down what executive presence is, then it's kind of just bad feedback. But executive presence is a thing, and that's what I'm saying.
Okay, and so we can do the same thing for customer centricity, right? Where yeah. Okay, this makes sense, because for executive presence, I'm thinking through this. You could say that breaks down, if we're going to use this as the analogy, that breaks down into the ability to be concise and storytelling and presenting options instead of saying no, and putting on your company hat instead of your department hat, right? Like you could break it down into actual competencies and actual pieces of feedback.
Right.
So we could similarly, like, customer centricity itself doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot on its own, but can be broken down into distinct components.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Let's do that. That sounds like fun.
Okay, cool.
So what's the best way to do that? Should we talk about like what components we see that make up customer centricity?
Yeah.
And then we can like go into examples of seeing them, not seeing them.
Yeah. Love it.
Okay, great. Okay. We have a structure. Perfect.
Yeah. I know. I love the podcast. Okay. So let's think about, all right. So what would you say if someone says to you, hey, Adam, what is customer centricity? And we'll do the whole like looking it up in the dictionary situation in a minute, but like just what's top of mind for you when you hear that term?
For me, I would say like what makes a business customer centric versus not customer centric is that you put customers at the center. I'm going to try to make this not a complete tautology. You put customers at the center of your decision making. So like if I had to imagine where this term originally came from, it's that there are a lot of businesses out there who make decisions purely off the balance sheet. And that would be, I guess we could call that a, what do we want to call that? A business-centric business or a finance-centric business?
I think we should say like short-sighted, because the thing is, it's like customer centricity is good business is like the argument, right? So I don't think how you could be business centric without having an element of customer centricity, but maybe like in the days of yore, people that were like solely focused, I guess your point is, on top line.
Exactly. Or even bottom line, right? Like I think there's in a lot of cases, there are companies that get acquired by PE, and that's private equity. I feel like we always need to define our acronyms. So like you might have a product business that's bought by private equity. And what the PE firm is doing as their owners is not really asking anything of them to spend a lot of time with their customers. They're not asking them to think about what customers might do that gets more value out of the company. Like they're just saying bottom line, bottom line, bottom line, cut costs, cut costs, cut costs.
Yeah.
And yes, there are some areas where generally they're going to think to cut costs versus others, but it really is about, to your point, like short-term revenue, internal efficiency. So top line, bottom line, and that doesn't necessarily involve listening to customers or doing what customers want the business to do.
Designing around the customer. I think like, to that point, one of the things I always think about, particularly in my current context, is you know how like when we're overly trying to be business, like internally business focused, like again being like short-sighted, we're trying to do everything possible to prevent a customer from getting support, as an example.
Yes. Yeah, right? Totally.
That is a marker of like, you know, you're like hiding your support forms, you're like, you, there's never any way to like, you know, like have a chat or a phone call or like a, you know, just the ability to even open a ticket. Like those are the types of things I think that start to feel not customer centric. So like, how would we articulate that as a quality when you're actually...
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think we could even call it that on its own, right? Like... Yeah. It's prioritizing efficiency or contact rate or those type of like internal metrics over the customer experience or like the customer being able to.
Or when it's those things are at odds, I would say, because you do like a lot of customers, like I don't, when I open a support ticket, I don't want to talk to a human actually.
No. And like, and a lot of people don't, but like when you need to, you should be able to.
Exactly. Right. So it's like,
You shouldn't be focused on contact rate above all else. Contact rate, you should be, if you're customer centric, you use contact rate as almost like a control metric where it's like customers should still be getting in touch with you for a certain number of things.
Yeah.
It just shouldn't be the main way that they need to talk to you, because that's also not customer centric.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where this came from or who is like, who we have to credit for this, but you know, there's that kind of like cheesy thing of like whenever you're at an offsite or something, always have an empty chair at your...
Oh, I think that's an Amazon thing, right? Like all their meetings, they leave a chair empty.
Yeah, they leave a chair empty.
Because it's supposed to be the customer, sort of like, which like just made me think that like somebody was thinking Passover Seder and they're like, oh, this is like a really good idea. Yeah. Let's do a business Seder.
Make it a thing.
Why on this day of day do we prioritize our P&L? In this way.
Love it.
Why? Why on this night of nights?
That's okay. Great. That's right.
Okay. So future episode of CX Cetera, we're going to do business Passover Seder.
I love it. Okay. So there's something there about designing with the customer's like natural flow in mind versus like trying to do everything in your
power. Yeah. That's a good one. And then you just said design, and that also makes me think of another characteristic of customer-centric companies is that they design with their customers.
They design with their customers.
And it's not like here, I'm kind of positioning that against something else, which is like, okay, we just talked about one characteristic of customer-centricity versus non-customer-centricity being you're focused on the customer, not the business. But I often see almost the other thing, which like the other side of it, which is that even for a lot of product companies that aren't necessarily trying to be super internally efficient, they're still not customer centric because they're starting from a point of view that they know better than the customer when they design. So they prioritize things that they think seem cool. They prioritize things that fit their product vision, but they're not really taking customer feedback into account or co-creating things with customers, because it sort of comes back to this like, if Henry Ford had asked his customers what they wanted, they would have asked for faster horses.
Great point. Yeah, I love that one. And it sparked for me, I don't know why, something that you just said sparked for me that like age-old argument of if the UX is good enough, then we don't need XYZ things, which is probably...
Love that, Chester.
It's so not customer centric, but it's like disguised as being customer centric. And I think it's like,
why is that not customer centric? Tell me more.
Oh man. I actually,
cause I hate it, but I've never thought of it as not customer centric.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, first of all, I think it's a conceit. It's sort of, and this is why it like sparked it for me, right? Where it's like, we think that we can build better by ourselves often than including someone else in the design. We've like I've heard it referred to as inefficient, right? Or like over collaborative and like that kind of a thing. And so a lot of times like I'll, and I've been guilty of this having been in product before too, where it's like, you feel like your product is going to suffer if there's too much feedback, and that by eliminating every element of friction, and you know what those elements of friction are by just doing a little bit of UX research, that the customer shouldn't need anything else. And that if they do,
yeah, perfect.
Like you made a bad decision, which to me, it's buttonology, it's feature focused, it's jobs to be done focused, and it doesn't really take into account the customer's broader context, preferences and outcomes, because UX is not necessarily about like broader customer outcomes. It is about fulfilling a task within a product. It's not about the customer's context. It's about yours.
Okay. I love that. And I actually never thought about it that way before, but it makes complete sense to me because it does. It assumes that you know better than the customer about how the product should be used. And if you could just make the product intuitive enough, then the customer would need support. But at least for most of the context that we're in, most like B2B SaaS, and I think now even a lot of AI companies are going to run into this, is that you can't create a product that is so intuitive that it completely teaches itself. You have to meet the customer where they are in terms of what they're trying to do with your product and actually help them do that.
Right. And I think that can't we all just vibe code something that like works the way that we want now? So it doesn't it have to be about more?
Yeah. Well, and like even here, like there's so many shoulds and justs, you know, exactly. Kind of baked into the formula here that at some point it's like, okay, yes, it should be that way. And they should just be able to do that thing. But in reality, they're not. So like, are we going to spend the time to figure out why? Or are we going to continue saying like, oh yeah, but they can just do it that way?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is also why I think that a lot of times we confuse like product-led growth with other types of like customer growth that are necessary for like a successful business. And same thing with sales-led, right? It's like we like overthink parts of the puzzle that like we happen to work in, and we don't really think of the system holistically. And I think that can be not customer-centric when you silo those things. So for example, like you'll have product-led growth teams that never speak to anyone in customer success as they're building onboarding flows. Like, why are the people that are responsible for onboarding customers and the people that are responsible for in-product onboarding not constantly speaking to each other? I don't know. But in the majority of companies that I've been in, that is the case, right? Like, you'll have your go-to-market teams on one side and you'll have your product or R&D teams on the other side all trying to onboard people, and like never the two shall meet. And, you know, and then we sit around wondering like what's happening to our daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly active usage and why it's like abysmal, right? It's like we all have pieces of the puzzle that we like refuse to bring together. We'll infight for like a million years, but we won't really hours for the greater good of our own company. Like, that drives me insane.
Me too. I would almost split that into two things. There's like, to be customer centric, number one is you actually have to build talking to customers into the core of much all roles in the company, but I would say especially your product and design teams.
Yeah.
So that you're building for customers and your product is surviving contact with actual customers. You're not just like looking at a dashboard as an indicator of how customers are doing with your product. And then the second thing that you kind of just called out with infighting is, I think like one big difference between customer-centric organizations and non-customer-centric organizations is the amount of time they actually spend like kind of prioritizing for customers and letting customer evidence solve disputes and frankly just delivering for the customer, like being clear on what needs to be delivered for the customer versus the amount of time spent on either infighting or what I've seen in some organizations. And we can tell stories, I'm sure we both have stories about this. It's like the priorities you hear or like the things that you're asked to prioritize on a day-to-day basis aren't really about the customer. They're about appeasing some internal stakeholder or some internal personality. And worked at organizations where when it came down to these types of decisions or like the amount of time spent in certain conversations, I heard the name of certain like internal mid-senior managers way more than I ever heard the name of any customer or any piece of actual customer feedback.
Yeah. The hippo, right? Like in the room.
Yeah.
It's
the hippo. The hippo means the highest paid person's opinion.
Yeah. Which is like, funny. Which is how a lot of decisions get made. Right. And I think it's very difficult when we're all trying to do more with less and we're all under a lot of pressure and speed is like the ultimate advantage and blah, 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 blah. And the economy's rough and blah, blah, blah. Like, to actually take a step back and not default to making decisions that way. Because you kind of bend the knee to the hierarchy over the customer a lot, because it's just the path of least resistance, right? Like, and so I think that is not customer centric, right? And I'm not saying like it has to be exclusively one way or the other, but I think it is interesting to think about how organizations make decisions and how people do the like Steve Jobs, like same outfit thing in decision making to like avoid that fatigue, right?
Yeah. My favorite trend.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just kind of like, to me, that those are the places where you realize if your company is customer centric or like lacking in that capability.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a lot of now good, I think. Yeah. Your original question was what comes to mind outside of the definition when you think about customer centricity. And I think we just actually... Maybe we actually did what you were saying at the very beginning. It was like we did now break customer centricity down into several characteristics. And if I try to remember them, because I wasn't writing as I go, but like maybe we can try to summarize this. It was like focusing on long-term goals instead of short ones, or focusing on like customer value more so than just the balance sheet.
Yep.
There was designing products with customers instead of like just assuming that you know best.
Know what they need. Yep.
There was prioritizing customer feedback and needs over internal politics and stakeholders' needs.
And I think like part of that was too like not building in silos, right? Because ultimately,
Yeah,
it's like ultimately all the customer's experience. And then, yeah, and I don't think we
And there was also not hiding support or other like customer paths to value or right, like impeding the customer experience. And sorry, there was one we didn't talk about.
No, I was gonna say that I think that sometimes, and so no, it's a separate point. I'll bring it up later. What I was gonna talk about is like how sometimes when we're trying to be customer centric, we can sort of organize our processes or even like our organization in a particular way, which I think hides the fact that we don't have the like baseline of customer centricity built up, that our like decisions and the way that we incentivize our teams to work actually prioritize. Like what I'm trying to get at, like here's an example of one of these things just to concretize it. Sometimes we think that if we like reorg, like we can reorg our way into customer centricity. And I think like what we're trying, the point we're trying to make in a lot of what we just talked about is like, you actually cannot do that, right? Reorg all day, but ultimately like you still have to figure out how your organization can scale customer feedback and include it in every build on every team, right? And so I think there's something missing there about like how we do voice of the customer and how that's like embedded into everything that we build and we do, like that's like slightly different from UX research. But you kind of mentioned it with the like where the customer stories piece that you said, right? Like it's like when we're making decisions, how do we make sure that we're actually looking at customer examples, right?
But and you also kind of mentioned it in your siloing point. Like I think like I think it's kind of embedded maybe in a couple of things we said. It could be its own thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we have like a good working model. Where do we go from here? Do we want to get a dictionary definition of customer centricity, or do we want to like start?
If we missed anything, like let's just see what good old ChatGPT, the Googs, and everybody has to say about this. Like, because we obviously like are riffing here.
Yeah.
And
customer
so,
centricity in a B2B business means putting the customer's needs, goals, and success at the core of every decision, strategy, and interaction across the entire organization.
Okay.
Are you ready for a very AI sounding sentence?
Yes, do it.
It's more than good customer service. It's an operating philosophy that aligns your product, operations, marketing, sales, and success functions around delivering long-term value to and with your customers.
Great. Yeah. I got the same practice of aligning a company's product, services, operations, and culture. Culture, that's an interesting one. Around the current and future needs of its customers in order to build loyalty, satisfaction, and long-term business success. And it says in tech and SaaS, because that was in my prompt, I was like, be specific to tech and SaaS, means continuously using customer feedback, behavior, and success outcomes. Okay, we talked about some of this. To inform product development, support models, pricing strategies. Ooh, we didn't talk about that. Pricing strategies and inherently customer-centric is actually a newer concept now, right? Like, and even org structure.
You're talking about like outcomes-based pricing and things like that?
Outcomes-based pricing. And I think even just like the repricing that people went through, you know, like I've seen a lot of companies reprice when there's competitive pressure to do so, when you've got competitors coming out of the woodwork and like your kind of sole fabulous product is no longer the only one in the market. And so there's like a ton of pressure as you start to notice like attrition due to just pricing to lower the prices, which is a race to the bottom. So, but I've still, you know, like, I think that that can be sometimes business pressure and the pricing can be designed again, like not necessarily in a way that is encouraging a customer's growth and outcomes, and like that flywheel doesn't really exist. So I've seen that for sure. But to your point, like, I do think the like usage-based pricing and outcomes-based pricing models are like a response to that.
Yeah. I think there's also like... something else is coming to mind as we're talking about this, which is like maybe this is part of culture, maybe this is part of metrics, I don't know, but it's like how you look at certain data points and what you do with them matters. Because like, for instance, you can look at support tickets at operation as an operational metric, because they are. But what you do with support tickets matters. Like, are you purely looking at how to get fewer support tickets? Are you looking at how to triage them? Are you really treating it as a support concern?
Yeah.
Or are you looking at support tickets as an indicator of what customers are trying to do with the product, funneling that to your product team, having them take those seriously? The question is like, how close do you bring everyone in the organization to the customer? One of the things that some of the companies that I've worked at that I think are more customer-centric do is they either have a program, or in many cases, they even mandate a program where everyone in the company shadows support for some period of time,
yeah,
or answers support tickets themselves, so that everyone knows like what are customers actually asking? What are customers actually dealing with? And not just like operationally, how do we handle them and support, but like really like what are customers trying to do with the product?
Yeah. Yeah. I love this. I think it's one of the most like customer centric onboarding practices ever. Like we did it at Box when I was there onboarding, Intercom does it. And it's like, it's important even if you're in CX that you like go and you actually get into the support queue. I love that practice.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
Another obvious one, this just ChatGPT just reminded me about this, but like what like our new product introduction model is and like how we actually do releases and inform customers about these releases. I think that is another thing that you can say is customer centric or not, depending on how you do it. Like a lot of these things, the concepts are there and are supposed to be super customer centric, but it's all in the how and not in the what.
So like, let's talk through that. How do you do that release process in a customer centric way versus a non-customer centric way? Like if I'm in an organization and I'm trying to like diagnose, like, are we being customer centric? Like what would I look for?
One of the ways that I've seen this play out is obviously we're in companies that are always releasing. So they're mm-hmm. constantly releasing. We have updates, patches, et cetera, et cetera. But are you informing your customers of this like as it's happening? Have you considered like the downstream impacts to however they've configured your software? All that stuff sounds pretty simple, but like it actually tends to like I've been surprised at how many companies I've been at where like we won't inform an admin that a major change is coming. And then like when we do inform them like 2 days before, they'll be like, yo, actually, this is going to massively impact the way that I've configured this software or this platform, and I need X amount of time to change something, right? This is the change management piece. And a lot of times, like, we will implement changes and we won't think about some of the enterprise edge cases. And I know that they're like edge cases, but it's companies that are quite large.
Yeah, those edge cases are like the majority of your revenue. And everyone has a different version of it. Yeah.
Right. You know, so I think things like making sure that you, you know, are again, like talking to your customer facing teams, that there's like processes for either feature flagging or exceptions or you know, whatever it is, like having that whole thing mapped out and figured out and as a part of your motion in go to market and product is critical. And a lot of companies that I've been at that are like quite mature, I'm talking like, you know, 500 million in ARR or more, haven't even started it. And that's surprising to me.
It is surprising. Well, I think it's also because there's this sort of like unspoken norm, especially in SaaS and especially in, let's say, like Silicon Valley move fast and break things culture, that like you don't need to do this and that you should inherently prioritize product being able to move fast and release things fast. In fact, I was even having a conversation with your friend and mine, Matt Mulholland, about this not too long ago. I think we've talked about him on the show before, but he was on your team at Miro and just like super, super smart guy. And I was picking his brain about something that he had set up to use AI to sync like documentation change suggestions to product release suggestions. And he was talking about actually how like one of the principles that he had built into his solution was, well, like we should do this accounting for product being able to release as fast as possible and release, you know, when they want on a continuous basis. And I'm like, but why? Why is that a principle?
Mm.
And he was like, well, like, shouldn't it be like, he's like, a core belief that I have is that product should be able to move fast and release things. Like, okay. I think that is true in certain scenarios. Like when you're working in B2C, when it's like a low stakes product, or like, let's say like the stakes of an update coming without warning are like, maybe someone doesn't like it and they want Mark Zuckerberg to bring back the old Facebook. If this gets 2 million likes, but it's not like, it's not going to like break some like critical security process that you have running off an API or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Context for sure matters.
If customers are telling you that they expect you to give them this sort of heads up, then the customer-centric decision would be to say, hey, we are willing to either slow down our individual releases, or we are willing to put more of a pause or like bundle them somehow, because we're prioritizing customers being able to accept and integrate our releases over our ability to release fast. That would be a customer-centric versus a product-centric decision.
Right, right. Like how, like moving to a quarterly or whatever.
Yeah. Or even having, you know, some sort of process to give more of a heads up where it's like, hey, we're willing to like push back any given release date to say, between the time the product is finished and the time we release it to the customer, we are going to do these enablement activities for the customer.
That's right.
And a lot of companies don't do that. And you're right. Companies get really far in terms of ARR without necessarily having these sorts of processes in place, and often don't do it until they have really large enterprise customers who are yelling at them for doing this wrong.
Yeah. And I think that there's companies that have different perspectives on this, right? Like, I think there's companies that are actively trying to get out of the cycle, right? You might be a large company like Salesforce or Amazon that maybe like has the luxury to do things without some of this, right?
Well, I mean, even Salesforce does what? They do three annual releases. They do
three annual releases, yeah. But like, I think most of us know that customers have, like, we're just one in hundreds of tools in their tech stack, typically managed by, if you're in IT, same handful of people, and they don't have time for your nonsense. They want to know, right? And like, and you have to have done the thinking at least. I think that's the part of a lot of these release processes. It's like, yes, you want to inform, you want to enable, but you also want to inspire confidence that you've like really thought about the customer's scenarios, their configuration, their setup, their environment, their use cases, like all of that stuff.
Yes.
If you haven't done that thinking and it's not a part of this release process, that is inherently not customer centric.
Well, and I've had this conversation before, like with actual product teams, where it's like step one on that train is like, oh, well, we've already said what the product should do. It's in the PRD. And the PRD, for those of you who don't know, is like the document basically that talks about like what the product is supposed to do and what the specs are and all of that. But like a lot of companies don't do them consistently. A PRD might look completely different. Something might be written in there, but it's not like super, again, customer centric, or it doesn't really describe what the customer should really be able to do. So it's like, no, you can't actually get that information from the PRD. And then you sort of go down to the second stop on this train, which is like, okay, so still, why, like, shouldn't we be able to release things quicker because then we're bringing value to customers quicker? And you're like, in certain situations or in certain companies, yes. But especially when you're talking about B2B, especially when you're talking about larger companies and larger customers who have to do their own enablement to their teams based on what you're releasing, or they have to go test things in a staging environment, then no, you're not actually being customer-centric by bringing features to customers quicker. You're being customer-centric by bringing valuable features to customers in an organized manner so they can do the change management around it. You said change management earlier, and I completely agree. And it's like, that's a mindset shift where it's like, we might be willing to bring an individual feature to a customer 2 weeks later if it means we gave them proper enablement or a grace period.
That's such a good point. Yeah. I mean, like, there's a lot of like trade-offs that obviously teams have to evaluate before bigger features go out. And then there's like literal or things that we're not going to have these discussions around. But that's such a good point. I think particularly now for like AI first companies or AI companies, that's important, right? Because we are still in a place where, you know, there's some hype cycle, there's some, you know, like varying degrees of maturity on the change curve, you know, like people are navigating what is legit and what is a bit sort of like poised to be shelfware when it comes to AI, right? And so I think like particularly in these times, like the more change management you're doing around your release cycle, the more you're sensitive to the customer's setup, it's like almost, it's like it's back, right? Like I think we went too far away from that when we were very comfy in SaaS and, you know, making all the doll hairs. And we were just like, okay, like we can do whatever we want. We can release it. It's like continuous release over the top. But I remember like back in the, you know, like the initial days of SaaS, like I remember one of the first like managers that I had was like our head of engineering. He used to say like, look, we have to be able to build things in the product to get customers to use it in an intuitive way, but you cannot experiment on your customers. Like they don't like it. And like, you have to be very careful about how you do that, which are, you know, and this is like one of the most brilliant leaders I've ever worked for, right? Classic kind of engineering and, you know, product guy, like very Clue Train manifesto, like Philip K. Dick, et cetera, right? Like, and this is a person that I think today people would be like, what do you mean don't experiment on your customers? Like, that's like literally how we do things. And I don't think that's what he's saying. Like, what he's saying is responsible experimentation and change management. And, you know, it's like part of the software release cycle.
He doesn't mean like don't A/B test or exactly. Like don't do right. phased rollouts or something like that.
Right.
It's like, yeah, but no, I agree. I think that's, no, I would definitely include that in like that. That to me would be kind of a telltale sign of customer centricity.
Yeah.
Oh, this is another characteristic I think we might have missed because it's so obvious to us. Because you were talking about the early days of SaaS, and one thing that I was thinking about is this depends a little bit based on who your product is for, because some products are built for very specific personas, and some products are built to go wall to wall in an organization. Like when I worked at Slack, when you worked at Miro, that's basically how it was.
Yeah.
But there's something to be said about customer centricity with like, literally like how much do you think about the actual users of your product and prioritize feature development for them? Right. Like I think we can all think of some products, even like SaaS products that are like maybe they're full featured and maybe they have enough things that will check the right boxes on an RFP when someone is evaluating them. And maybe they can even, you know, kind of make the right arguments to their economic buyers. But as a user, they are terrible to use and they're not thought through and the features are underbaked. And like in a lot of cases, it's just kind of like a barely skinned database with limited functionality. And that's the product.
Yeah. That's a good point.
There's something to be said about like customer centric is also user centric.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I think that's why like so many of the things that like Notion has done, for example, are pretty inspiring like examples of customer centricity that they've like baked into the product, right? And I think some of those things have become now just like the way that you do stuff, right? A lot of, like I think like a lot of companies, it's not like just Notion, but like templates in a product.
Right, Notion is a great example, though, of like building templates directly into the. I mean, Figma. Figma. Well, yeah, Figma does it too. But also, I was thinking of like Canva, even right? Like companies that really think about what their end user is trying to do and offer it up to them directly in the flow of the product.
Yeah.
But I think like let's go back to Notion for a moment because I do I agree that they are one of the most customer centric companies out there, and like just the amount of investment that they've put into building their community, into driving their ambassador program, into doing customer education and user-led education and all of that. Like it's incredible. It's an incredible way of doing things, but it's, if I work at a company that isn't at Notion's level, like I sort of have to ask myself a question of, do those things come from me already having a very customer-centric product and culture? And so then I get a lot of fans who are willing to contribute to that versus to what extent do they need to come before I build it? Because I think like a lot of companies, they get that wrong. And when you're not being customer centric, you think like, oh, yeah, Notion has a community. Notion has education. Notion has ambassador programs. Like, let me build those and then get a lot of customers into those. And then, you know, they'll build stuff for us too. And then they'll be raving fans. And it's like, well, maybe, but like probably not, honestly, if you're going to make an investment in a community when you don't already have a lot of raving fans of your product, maybe the question you should start by asking is like, why you don't have a lot of raving fans of your product.
That's right. I think that's such a great point, right? Cart before the horse, for sure. And we see that all the time in, you know, in our line of work, for sure. I think it's like, there's this like launch mentality versus like a value mentality sometimes that is very like self, it's kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's just self-absorbed, right? You're very like, like, and you know what? That's, that reminds me too of like when you see those annual product conferences, you know, what are those like? Is this a company that's talking about themselves a lot in that conference? It's probably not going to be very customer centric, right? Or are those product conferences? Because that's like your stage for the like, year, maybe. It's like your tentpole event. How are you spending your time doing that? I think that's like a good indicator of what I think what you're talking about, which is that like, who's attending those? Like, you know, do you have
fans? I worked at a company where, in its early days, it was actually, I think, one of the earlier companies to product-led growth, right? Like they had a PLG motion and it was incredible and it brought in a lot of very early customers, but the company needed to move up market over time, especially as they were doing more fundraising and the space was evolving. And every year at our product conference, we had to kind of roll out the marketecture diagram. Mm-hmm. And that was meant to take all of our features and all of our development and pull them together into a logical story. But increasingly what we were hearing, especially in the next few years from our customers, is like, hey, it's cool that you're telling this story, but what we actually need is for you to take your core product and apply it to this other scenario, right? Because if we apply it to, I'm being a little bit deliberately vague because I don't want to just like throw this company under the bus, but like, you need to take that and apply it to this other scenario. And if you apply it to this other scenario, then we have another team in our company that will be able to use this as their core product.
How interesting.
And we didn't do that until it was too late. And I think our business suffered as a result. And I think our growth suffered as a result because we were kind of like, this is a complicated one because we thought we were being customer centric because we were like, hey, we have customers who are already using our product in this other way. So why don't we build this other thing for them, for the thing that we think they're already doing? But there was a conflict between that and between what so many of our customers was telling us they actually needed. And does that mean the company was or wasn't customer centric? I don't know. I don't think you can always paint with such a broad brush, but I think the decision and trying to orient around a certain idea of a marketecture diagram was a non-customer centric decision.
100%. And I've seen this exact thing play out too. So I was like trying to contain myself when you brought up marketecture diagram. That's a really good point. And you also, you reminded me of a hot take that I have, which I don't, you could decide if we spend time on it right now or not, because I don't know like if we're the most credible people when we say this. But I actually really do think, having been in all three of these departments, that if your like enablement or your education function is in marketing, that you are not very customer centric. I know. I just dropped like a hot take just very casually in there.
Go on. Let's expand that.
I know that we all do various things across the customer journey in all functions, but marketing's job is about the marketing funnel. And when we start to see too many, like we start to see too much cookie licking and moving things that are meant to help customers get value out of our product into marketing, when that is not the function that is like talking to customers about the product on a daily basis, it's natural, right? And I think there's, by the way, a ton of value to having education on the marketing side and bringing, education content higher up in the funnel for sure. But I think placing a function that is meant to get your customers to get value from your product through guidance in a consultative motion into marketing, it will suffer when it comes to depth. And I think it'll have a lot more breadth, but I don't think it's going to get to where you can really get your customers through emotion.
And it'll have more funding and it'll be higher gloss. But
yes, exactly.
No, you're right. Like I see this tension at a lot of companies where companies where I've worked as well, where it's like, who owns adoption? Does marketing own adoption because it's like a life cycle thing?
Yep.
Or does customer success own adoption? Or maybe you even want to throw like a third, does product own adoption?
Yep.
And you can debate which of those three, like or which of the remaining two are the right one, because there's the team that builds the product that needs to be adopted and the team that works with customers every day to get them to adopt and protect the revenue ultimately, which means that like they need to be adopting healthily. So I don't know if you can just say like one team owns adoption, period, the end. But marketing seems to have the least affinity based on what they really should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the key, really should be doing, right? So I think like I've seen, and I've been in marketing functions where we've gotten stretched too thin. And I've seen, and this is also like, I've seen a lot of the reorgs happen in this way where like you'll lift and shift enablement functions like into marketing out of somewhere where I think it makes more sense, like product or CX. And ultimately like, and I've been in three orgs where that's been the case, like where it's lived in marketing and it does suffer like every single time.
Yeah. You're actually coming to another point that I think is worth calling out, which is like, you have to think about what these functions do at their minimum, if they're underfunded or if they're stripped to their studs. And customer-centric versus non-customer-centric companies treat these in different ways. So product, push comes to shove. If you really put the screws on your product team and you put a lot of constraints on them, then a lot of their other metrics and their other priorities are going to go away. But like the thing that will probably stay is, you know, their release velocity or something like that, right? Like they just got to ship and do that as much as they can.
Right.
And then marketing, if stripped down to the studs, is going to be about the funnel or the flywheel or, you know, whatever lead generation mechanism that you want them to deliver. And that might be a little bit different if you have marketing split into like lead gen reporting to one place and product marketing reporting to another place, but let's simplify that one. CX or CS as a function, if they're stripped to their studs, well, a lot of the times it's not going to be like one metric that they prioritize, maybe churn, they go chasing churn, but like what you see is those teams either become incredibly reactive or they just get cut entirely. And the rationale behind that is like, again, it's one of those shoulds. And a lot of those shoulds are propagated by your friend and mine, Frank Slootman, or Slootman, if you want to be Dutch about it. right. The Snowflake CEO, and he was at ServiceNow before that. And he wrote the Amp It Up book. And like one of his big things is like, well, customer success shouldn't be a department. It should just be like the way that your company acts, or it should be like kind of a collective responsibility of other roles at your company. And it's like
half a dozen.
That's a big should. That's a big should, and it doesn't really work in reality. And so I think like what decisions your company makes first of all, around like in tough times, what to strip to the studs versus what to really prioritize, but also then like when things do get trimmed down, like how does your company behave and what do you prioritize? Like, I do think that's also a sign of customer centricity, right? Because you might choose to say, hey, like in dark times, we're going to cut down our customer functions, but we're going to try to keep, you know, selling and bringing in new business, or we're going to cut down our post sales, but we'll continue releasing product and just kind of hoping that it lands well with customers. So I think there's like something there.
Yeah. And like how you manage the swinging of the pendulum and, you know, like what comes out of that. I think we all know like tough decisions have to be made in tough times. And there are, no one is ever operating with all of the resources that they ideally would have to do the thing that they want to do at the highest quality they want to do it. And sometimes it's like, most times I would actually argue that's a good thing. Those constraints are like necessary for you actually to become a better version, of yourself as a team. And I think like having led teams that are like on the leaner side to do outsized impact, you can like learn a lot about how to be customer centric in those moments, because every action you take is worth, like, you know, the action of like five people on a scale team, for example. So, anyway, I think this is such an interesting concept. The other thing I will say is, like, there are a lot of companies that I think do a really good job of, like, performatively being customer centric, but then the actual processes internally, like, betray that. Like, for example, if you have a lovely, you know, community wish list, like Notion, for example, I think, like, has an incredible one, but you never actually,
you don't, no one looks at it or does anything with it.
You're not really talking about it at your community events or your product conference. And, like, what were the ideas, and, like, talking about the users that, like, submitted those or whatever originally. That to me is, like, a very performatively customer centric, but mm-hmm. not actually so. So, like, I think there's a lot of those types of behaviors too. And, you know, I think sometimes we have to take shortcuts, or we have too many things out there. And with, you know, with smaller teams being popularized, like, you're not necessarily going to be able to get all of your programs to their, like, you know, full Pokemon, like, most advanced, like, Pokemon form. But I think then you should cut. There should be less noise. But there's kind of no excuse for that, I would say.
Yeah. I think another one that's, like, kind of optically customer centric, but in reality not, is, like, there are teams that kind of, like, overinvest in their actual support metrics at the expense mm-hmm. of building better self-service, building better education, onboarding, all of the things that often our teams build. And yeah, okay, it's like a little bit self-serving for us to be talking about it, so I've tried not to spend that much time here, but I think there's something to be said about that, right? Where, like, you kind of you assume, or you create the impression, that being customer-centric means that when someone talks to a support agent, they're going to have the most delightful experience possible, when you brought it up earlier, like, a lot of people don't want to talk to support, so it doesn't matter how good your support metrics are. It matters what are the things that you do along the customer journey to truly help them be successful
yeah.
with what they're trying to do with your product, and having a deep understanding of what they're trying to do with your product.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And just to clarify, I started in support. I have a ton of respect for support. It's an incredible company. I don't want to talk Absolutely. To anyone. So it's not that I don't want to talk to support agents. I'm a millennial. I don't want anyone calling me. I don't want to call anyone. I'll just say that. So
yeah, agreed. Agreed. And I think there's still a lot of, like, outdated thinking
yeah.
out there. Like, even in, like, let's stop, you know, dumping on support for a moment. Cause, like, totally. And by the way, like, just because I don't want to talk on the phone, like, if I'm having a problem and it can't be solved with self-service, I want to chat with an agent.
Exactly.
Like, right. Like, yeah. we can put that out there.
Right.
But what I don't necessarily want to have, like, a QBR with a CSM just for its own sake. Like,
yeah,
I'd rather have a purposeful conversation about something that I'm trying to do with the product. Because, like, a lot of, like, again, these are things that sort of, like, they're framed as customer centric, but they're ultimately yeah. self-serving, right? Because the CSM yeah. is being incentivized on, like, how many QBRs did I set up with customer success manager, quarterly business review. That's yeah. CSM and QBR. I think probably everyone listening knows that. How many QBRs did I set up with yeah. a customer? And they're yeah. using that as a proxy for how much value am I delivering to customers. But, like, you know, you see now it's pretty obvious, like, that doesn't have a very strong relationship with loyalty or churn or retention.
Love it. 100%. At least we've got a good, like, starter definition, plus, like, things to, like, look for within our organizations that are or aren't customer centric. And, like, I think, to be clear, we're all always trying to be more customer centric and improve, you know, the ways in which we work to support our customers. But I think there's some clear ways in which sometimes we, you know, get off that path, and it's important yeah. to recognize when that's happening.
Totally. And I guess, yeah, that would be my closing thought as well, or, like, similar to that, which is, like, if you're looking at your own organization, or maybe you're interviewing at an organization, how do you know whether that the organization is truly customer centric or not? I think, like, first, I would say, as with many things, this is a spectrum. It's not that a company is all or nothing, right. like, customer centric or not customer centric. Like, think of customer centricity more as, like, things you do rather than things you are.
Yeah.
So, and so then if you kind of follow that definition or that concept, look at the decisions that your company is making, decisions that value customer empathy, that value meaningful long-term customer adoption and retention. Look for how much they're talking about customers as humans and as users, not just as revenue. Like, look at all of those decisions, and you sort of have to ask yourself, like, how frequently are decisions being made to prioritize the customer and their long-term value, and of course the revenue that comes with it, versus other things, whether the other things are like product's ability to to operate independently, or your ability to generate new business, or your ability to upsell your existing customers, right? Like, customer centricity comes in those trade-off moments.
Yeah, totally. And I think look also at just like structurally how your organization thinks about collaboration. I think that's like such an old school, obvious one, but healthy organizations that are customer centric are going to actually incentivize and support breaking down of silos, working together, bringing skills, competencies together, like in service of the customer, and not reorg themselves to death while customers churn. So
that'd be I love it.
Amazing. Cool. Let's go be more customer centric, Adam.
Let's go be more customer centric, and let's ask people on LinkedIn, what are your telltale signs that a company is customer centric or non-customer centric? And I'd love for people to answer this from a couple of lenses. Like, you could talk about what, you know, companies you've worked at are doing, but you can also talk about, and you and I didn't even talk about it that much, but I think it was sort of like baked into our subconscious, companies that we've worked with, because we are customers of companies too, and we know when they're being customer centric or not customer centric. So like, you can answer from either way, but I'm really curious to hear people's examples.
Me too. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you could find a review mechanism, whether that's on Apple or wherever you're podcasting, please give us...
Preferably Apple.
It is Apple, right? Like, that's the one?
Apple's the big one.
What do we want? We want stars, we want thumbs. How many thumbs do we
want? We want stars. We want people to use their thumbs on their phone to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, because then that's the first thing people usually see when they're searching for our show, and it will give us a great reputation, but only if we are delivering value to you. So we want to be customer centric, and we want you to come in our LinkedIn page, and you can get in touch with us on LinkedIn. You can tell us what you like and don't like about the show. Like, we genuinely are asking a lot of questions about what is working with this show so far. So tell us, and we're going to be customer centric too.
Yes. And leave us qualitative feedback too. We love all the comments. We thank you for listening.
Thanks everyone. And we'll see you in the comments.
See you in the comments. Bye. Actually, are we live or whatevs?
We're live or whatevs.
So we should talk about this. So tell me about this error that you just told me about that people make.
So this is one of my pet peeves where I just came on Riverside twice. So there were 2 images of me, and then there was 1 image of you in the middle.
Yes.
Right? You correctly said it is a D sandwich on Adam bread. But most people don't say that. Most people say it's an Adam sandwich. And that's wrong. That's not how you describe a sandwich. You don't say I'm eating a rye sandwich. You say I'm having like pastrami on rye.
Yeah.
It is a D sandwich on Adam.
Right. The sandwich is the thing in the middle. Yeah. It's a good pet peeve. I don't have whole wheat sandwiches, you know?
Like, no, you don't have whole wheat sandwiches, you don't have sourdough white bread sandwiches. Yeah, exactly. You don't describe the sandwich by the bread.
Yeah.
You don't describe the sandwich by the bread.